Okay, so I thought I'd start with a joke, but we're gonna not do that. And you still laugh. Yeah, actually, I want to start off by just saying thank you to Roshi and John. I imagine they're the ones who decide who does this kind of thing and when. I'll be leaving staff in a few months, and this has been a really nice way to reflect, process, look back over these last almost 3.5 years on staff. As Sasheen Roshi says, not to reflect, not to look back over the week and go up until that bell. Don't be tempted to look back. But I feel like this has been a really nice time of looking back, and it's more like the Shavasana of my staff experience, just that last 15 minutes to kind of process and integrate and not feeling like, oh, I'll never have another yoga class again, but just to appreciate the class we've just gotten through. So, coming to the path. So the path all started in 1978. I was born first in my family out of 5 kids. And I feel like there are the oldest children face many similar kinds of challenges. This isn't all oldest children, but there are quite a few of us who deal with a lot of self-perfectionism, a lot of feeling overly responsible for things that we're not responsible for, defensiveness that I think comes with this kind of mindset, and with self-perfectionism comes kind of like an expectation of perfection in our situations and other people, and so leads to a lot of judgment. So yeah, I think there's a lot of burdens that come with being the center of attention for one's early childhood. And yeah, I feel like a lot of practice has been, for me, has been recognizing that stuff and realizing that it doesn't have to be there, that it is there, but it doesn't have to be attached to, followed up on, listened to. So I have real empathy for anybody else in the room who has to deal with that, because it kind of sucks. My parents, very extroverted people. My dad, he's the youngest of 5, so I think I love him. He needs a lot of attention. My mom, she has the nickname the compulsive hostess, your compulsive hostess. So another extrovert. And so I think growing up, I had a real expectation towards putting out a lot of energy. That was normal. Between my mom and my dad, they really put out a lot of energy. So I think I grew up, really feeling like, okay, this is how people are. We put out a lot of energy. And that has been another really wonderful part of practice, this kind of finding a middle way, not to put out too much, but not to withhold, not to guard. So it's been really interesting kind of finding my way in that over the last several years. And so after, this is so organized, it's great. Parents, siblings. Being the oldest of 5, and I don't know if other people had this situation too, we were desperate to differentiate ourselves. I don't know if it's because our parents, they kind of had their own things going. So I think each of us felt that they needed their own way to get attention. which meant, you know, none of us could be doing it in the same way. So, okay, so we all end up playing an instrument, but we had to play different instruments, or we all played sports, but we had to play different sports. We all kind of approached school and academics in different ways. So it's really funny, because I still see it in myself. I see it less and less between us, but especially when we were children, man, we had to be different than the other kid. Or if some kid had already kind of claimed something as their own, it's like, oh, I can't play the trumpet. You know, he already plays the trumpet. Or I can't do that sport. No, Emily's a swimmer. I couldn't like swimming. No way. So yeah, this it's really funny. And yeah, I mean, people do this kind of thing all the time. It's yeah, to see that's where it comes from for me. It's really funny. As a child, I think in addition to the kind of navigating that extroversion versus introversion differentiation, I in this process of reflecting, you know, looking back, and man, I had this killer temper. I mean, there were five of us. We fought all the time, and there were times where I just flew off the handle, would just lay a beat down on another sibling, and would feel terrible about it. I mean, right away, there wouldn't be any space to like be, oh, I really shouldn't have done that. It would go from just in the red rage to in the blue remorse. I mean, I would like pull my fist away and be crying, like, I'm so sorry that I've just done this. It's really weird. I haven't thought about that much, but in this process, like, man, what was going on there? I would love to talk to a therapist. You know, I would love to just... I mean, that's honestly one of the things I'm looking forward to with leaving staff is having money again. And and like having the money to talk to a professional about this kind of stuff. Because it's just, I mean, it's fascinating. Where the hell does that come from? I don't know. Anyways, continuing. So other things that I dealt with. Fairness, justice. I, as a child, had a huge sense that things should be just. I mean, constantly that was something I would fall back on. That's not fair. That's obviously not fair. And I mean, my siblings and I, we were all very different from each other. So my poor mother had to deal with us in different ways. And I would just constantly get all bent out of shape, you know, that's not fair. And I think that's one of the wonderful things about Buddhism and about this idea of this true nature, is it really appeals to this deep sense in myself of us all being innately born with, imbued with. We all have this true nature and in equal amounts. Absolutely. You know, that's just so fair. You know, that's just so right. That's one thing I really love about this way is, you know, at the real heart of it, it's just really fair. And I guess like the last thing, I kind of said this with the oldest child thing, but I think you know, just really was a perfectionist, and you know, in school, that, I mean, it's good in school, you know, you get good grades when you're a perfectionist a lot of the time, but man, you know, it can really create a lot of anxiety. I remember a lot of late nights with homework or projects and trying to get things just right. Oh God, wrapping presents. I don't know if any of you experience this kind of thing. Terrible, you know. Especially stuffed animals. You know, we had all these kids, and so you're giving stuffed animals, and wrapping a stuffed animal for this kind of obsessive gift wrapper is not a good match. Yeah, I think I just switched to books. I'm like, I'm only giving books. So much easier to wrap. I grew up Catholic. This is a Catholic primary school. We lived on the street from our Catholic primary and middle school. It was a K-8 school. A lot of the neighborhood, there was just a lot of Catholic families because the church was right there. The cathedral. That's what we're looking for. The cathedral right down the street. So yeah, a lot of Catholic families around, which meant just a tremendous sense of community. Kids I would go to school with and I would see at church on Sunday. We went through our kind of rites of passage together, First Communion and all of the other sacraments, which now it just seems silly. I hear another giggle. It's cool, right? I mean, really, it's wonderful to be a part of a community like that. And actually, it's funny, for a while out at Chapin Mill, there was just four of us, and Wayman was the odd man out. Errol and Ed and I were all Catholic in kind of pre-Buddhist life, and I really think there is something to it. I mean, not that all Catholics necessarily have a sense of community, but I think it's something that really does appeal to us at the Zen Center, is that there is a community and, kind of used to it. I was an altar server. I love the kind of, the robes and the candles and the incense. I loved altar serving, man. I liked, just chilling with the priest. You felt like you're kind of like in on the secret, Oh, this is where they keep the wine, and here's the bread, and it's in this room, and I know where the key to this room is. It's really, it's kind of like a backstage pass. It was really cool. Yeah, I liked altar serving. In this kind of community thing, I had a wonderful childhood. I mean, really storybook kind of childhood. When JP asked me to do this talk, I was like, man, there is not the kind of drama in my life that a lot of other people have had. I hope, the Sangha can deal with this kind of PG coming to the path talk. it was great. We had an in-ground pool, and, lots of kids would come over, played Little League for years, and did Cub Scouts and Boy Scouts, did the whole summer camp thing, and played D&D, and, summers we were outside in the yard trashing it, and in the winter, we were sledding and building snow forts. I mean, it was really like, storybook childhood. It was wonderful, parents are great, kids are great, and we fought a lot. I'm sure we did some stupid stuff, but it wasn't terrible, nobody got terribly injured, some broken bones, some stitches every once in a while, but nothing too crazy, nothing too outside of the norm. And friends and family, they were really stable. So wonderful childhood. Maybe that helps me to have this really deep faith in our true nature, having a very stable environment for those formative years, really gives me tremendous faith in this kind of innate, kind of happy perfection, satisfied perfection. It's really, a wonderful part of life. So in middle school, things, got a little interesting. As far as, the real stuff to work with. written down, middle school, started trend, pursuing the uninterested. And that's kind of pointing to my romantic relationships through middle school and high school. You know, just for some reason, I was punching over my weight, man. I was just pursuing women that were not interested. Women, right? They were girls. And yeah, what it really did not do any good for my self-esteem, because it just meant a lot of rejection. And, you know, it made me more shy, kind of transitioning from this school where there's a real community, then into high school where, where it was much more of a big pond. I remember, I was part of our little, peer ministry group in middle school, and so it was a mix of middle school kids and high school kids, and this kid who, you know, I looked up to, he was maybe 3 years older than me. He goes, you know, you might be good at it, you might get good grades now, you might be good at sports now, but I'm telling you, you go into high school, and there's always going to be kids who are smarter. There's always going to be kids who are better. Just get used to that. And I really took that at face value. I was like, man, okay, wow. I won't be the same kind of person in high school. And it's really a shame because, it took me a lot of my high school career to kind of get back to the kind of free person that I had been in middle school. You know, I was like valedictorian in my, in this eighth grade graduation going into high school, and, you know, I had wonderful friends and relationships, and not that I didn't in high school, but, you know, I definitely kind of put up some walls and, just was much more guarded in high school and for really no good reason. But hey, adolescence, it's a pisser. In high school, I was a band geek. It's a really kind of in a cliquey high school environment that I went through. You know, I kind of defined myself by, you know, being a band geek. Still church going, was part of, in high school we called it peer ministry. Actually, this is interesting. I told Wayman this story a little while ago. When I was, a sophomore, junior maybe, a priest at, I went to this Catholic high school, Aquinas. Priest at Aquinas, knew I was an altar server, and I was in a class of his, and he had taught my best friend also, and he wanted to take us to the headquarters, mothership, whatever they call it, for the Basilian Fathers, the father house, some kind of house maybe. But anyways, so this is in Toronto. Their HQ is in Toronto. And he wanted to take me and Mark there because, I think he had the idea that we would become priests. You know, this is a guy who had been in the band at Aquinas. He had become a priest. And so here we were band kids at Aquinas. And yeah, I think he had this idea of priesthood for us. I can't remember if he said that explicitly, but I mean, basically, Mark and I, we knew the story. And, it's really interesting, you know, to have gone through this semi-monastic experience here at the Zen Center. And, even in high school, you know, I was kind of primed for that kind of experience. It was in high school that, and around this time that I got my first hint of possibly having some kind of karma with Buddhism. I think every few years, whether it's, Mark Hare or other, writers for the DNC, they do something on Buddhism or on the Zen Center. And so this was just another article that had come out, and I read it. I remember being at my best friend Mark's house and reading this newspaper article. I'm like, man, I think I want to become a Buddhist. He's like, shut up, man. Come on. Yo, you're Catholic. We do all this altar serving together. Yo, get over it. You're not going to... Okay, yeah, you're right. You're right. Yeah, it's kind of bullshit. So, little would he know, you know, years later. So, yeah, like I said earlier, it wasn't until my senior year where I really started to kind of blossom a bit. I was doing more activities rather than just band and, you know, cross country, I guess, as well. But senior year, you know, I did all three seasons of track. I was in AP courses because now I wasn't really afraid of, yeah, just getting my hands dirty with academics. I was playing a lot of music. There was a lot of band stuff going on. I was the lead in our musical. So yeah, I was a leader in that peer ministry group. So yeah, it was senior year where I really just was getting my hands dirty and not afraid of just kind of being myself and, just getting more comfortable. There's still no girlfriend. I was still, you know, pursuing just stupid relationships, but I think things are getting better. I think I was, you know, starting to get a sense of, you know, who I would really jive with. And then I went to school. I went to SUNY Geneseo, which was far enough away so that I really got a break from my family, but was close enough so that if I did need some family support, it wasn't that far away. My kind of undergraduate career started being very academically focused. You know, I was really there to work. I really took my grades quite seriously, you know, that perfectionism still really being a part of my identity. And through my undergraduate career, that shifted. I mean, I was in a couple bands, and I was doing the radio, and just kind of less interested in really killing myself with the academic stuff, and just being a bit more well-rounded, kind of whole. It was also in my first year at undergrad where I had my really this first glimpse into identity. I remember walking across campus and realizing that, like, none of these people know me. Like, I could be whoever I wanted in this new place. Like, I can be totally, absolutely outgoing, and no one would know that that isn't how I've always been. And I recently watched a TED Talk about this. This woman who had a I can't remember what kind of accident, but real, like, maybe a stroke or in a car accident. But anyway, she had been a really serious academic, and something happened where she just, like, lost 50 points of her IQ, really, I mean, just, you know, in an instant, and had a real identity crisis, and somehow found this, like, you can just fake it till you make it. And and I don't know how much I changed on that day or anything, but I remember just thinking, like, yeah, identity is really funny. Like, whose is it? Is it theirs because of, you know, their view of me? Is it mine? Yeah, weird. So yeah, that was my first little glimpse into that identity thing that came up a few more times. When I was undergrad, another step in my kind of karmic relationship with Buddhism came when I made the change to vegetarianism. I was in church, and this woman walks in with a fur coat, and I remember just being so disgusted, just being like, oh man, okay, that's it, no more. I've been thinking about it, but it hadn't ever hit me so hard. So yeah, I stopped eating meat. Then, you know, I was cooking for myself, so it was no big deal. It was my junior year. Okay, so this is when things really changed. This is when I first got into Zen, and this is my first real, like, good romantic relationship. I'd had a couple small relationships in undergrad before this, too, but nothing that went anywhere. And so, junior year was, like, my first big relationship at last. Jesus Christ, 20 years old. But more interesting to you guys maybe is this whole Zen thing. So I took this comparative religion course, which was great because up till this point it seemed like every goddamn class I took was either a chemistry or biology or math or physics class. So yeah, I mean I got a BS in biochemistry, so it's just so much science. So I just absolutely loved these classes outside of my own discipline because I could, you know, not learn somebody else's stuff that they had already found out, you know, really kind of make it my own. And yeah, so we took this comparative religion class, which was wonderful, had a great teacher. And for Buddhism, we read Zen and the Art of Archery. And I remember reading this tiny book, and it just rang so true. I don't know if other people here have read this, but it was just wonderful. Like, where has this been? How? Of course, yes, of course. So it kind of took me a while to figure out. Just a few months and talking first to my professor and then another professor who gave me some material and then found out, oh my God, we have this Zen center in Rochester. Are you kidding me? And, I called up and Errol answered the phone and I came to my first workshop. I got a ride from a professor who was coming in from Geneseo, which is great because didn't drive, no car. How was I going to get there? But totally worked out. So I was sitting, you know, just sitting. For a lot of my, I don't know, first 10, 12 years or so. Close to 10 years. It was really up and down. I imagine other people had that experience too, you know, peaks and valleys with my sitting. But this got the ball rolling. That was great. And then the romantic relationship, you know, that was wonderful too. You know, I think I have a lot of expectations because of my parents, you know, really wonderful marriage, and I had a great partnership with this woman. I mean, it turned out it was kind of rocky in the beginning because I imagine it was because of my kind of initial adventures in the romantic pursuits were so just didn't go anywhere. So I think I had a ton of anxiety over relationships, which meant that our first dates, like, I had panic attacks. You know, I remember, like, we went out to see a movie, and after the movie, we left, and I had to throw up. I threw up. Incredible. And at first, I thought, So I'm talking to her about it. I mean, it's not like I could hide this thing. Like, man, I gotta throw up. She was really cool about it. I think that's really why things worked out. She's really chill. This is really funny. So at first, I had it was during the winter break of junior year, and other people, you've been through college, you know, winter break, you got a lot of free time, man. If you're not working, there's a ton of downtime. So I was doing all kinds of crap, you know, like serious exercise regimen. And like, I was, baking. So anyways, that day I had made brownies, and of course, there's tons of batter left over. So I probably ate half a cup of this brownie batter, and I thought, oh man, maybe it was the raw egg in that brownie batter that made me sick to my stomach. I had no idea that this anxiety thing was really an issue until it continued to happen. For the next, I don't know, few dates, I just remember, like, having to throw up. Crazy. But we got through it. I mean, she was cool about it. I mean, what was really nice... Oh, actually, no, one more funny thing. Yeah, I didn't even write... this is just coming out now. She thought I might be bulimic. Like, because I was throwing up, I had this exercise regimen. I'm a thin guy. It's like, oh, wow, maybe Dan's bulimic. But no, it just turns out I was kind of, high-strung anxiety. What are you going to do? But yeah, I mean, we had a great relationship. I mean, we dated for 2.5 years. We, once we graduated, so that was at the, 1.5 year mark, she moved to New York City. She really wanted to, she grew up in Rochester as well, in Greece. But, she wanted that big city life. And it just wasn't in me. I wasn't that interested. The bands were still going really strong with Graduation. And yeah, I just didn't feel, I just wasn't down with making the move. And, I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I just didn't feel like New York was my scene. And so after a year of a long distance relationship, we broke up, and that was a huge loss. I mean, at the time, not as big, because, I was living with a lot of the bandmates, had really fun lifestyle. It was really, it was really great. But, I think just losing my best friend like that reflecting back, those next few years, it was a big, big loss. Yeah. I mean, probably that's the biggest loss to date. I mean, besides the ends of my fingers, that is the, I would say emotionally, the biggest loss in my life so far. So my senior year, I didn't know what to do with myself. My dad wanted me to go into toxicology. He thought I'd have a really nice lifestyle doing that. But it wasn't really sitting well with me. And luckily, I taught this freshman biology lab. There was a bunch of us who had kind of stuck it out with staying in science and staying, on top of things. And so, a handful of us were asked to be the TA for these freshman labs. And I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I had a great relationship with the freshmen. I had become kind of disenfranchised from being a scientist. It just felt like I was memorizing all kinds of ridiculous pieces of proteins. Like, why the hell am I memorizing this? And it just seems such a waste. But, when the freshman asks questions about this crap, I'm like, oh, yeah, shoot, I know that. Yeah, sure. Shame you have to, too. But, this is what we're paying for. So I was like, man, this teaching thing is pretty sweet. I can do this. I can get used to this. And so that's what I went to graduate school for. Yeah, I found out that I didn't need to go to graduate school for anything that I had previously studied. It's like a kind of blank slate. Like, well, yeah, I'll get a master's in education, get certified to teach. And I was advised to teach chemistry. On paper, I was a better chemist. My interest was more in biology, I'd say, if I had to, make a judgment on it. But so I was kind of pushed to to teach chemistry, so I did. And so, you know, I was kind of following my heart on that one, but kind of not. And so I think eventually that's why I became a little bit unsatisfied with it. You know, this is kind of the beginning of that, but it was a fine match. You know, I can talk about science. It's cool. But yeah, I mean, I really love teaching. You know, I like hanging out with kids. Yeah, it's a great pursuit. Yeah, in graduate school, it was easy, man. I mean, after busting my ass as a biochemist, learning the education stuff was a breeze. It was great, and I felt like I could have some ownership, and I was sitting, you know, I was coming to the Zen Center then. Yeah, I remember an early volunteer day out at Chapin Mill where we were like varnishing floorboards, you know, like for the exercise room or something, you know, really early on. And yeah, my early impressions of Wayman being this like slave driver, which has evolved quite a bit. But yeah, yeah, it was really interesting because that was such a different life than now. You know, and my relationship with the Zen Center has changed so much. My relationship with sitting has changed so much. So it was great having this chance in this talk to look back and be like, wow, I was sitting then. That was such a different time, and I was sitting. That's weird. So after school, start my career, started it in the city schools, and it was a freaking madhouse. Tons of anxiety because I was going into a war zone every day. Sundays, like I could hardly eat Sunday dinner, I remember, because I just knew what was coming on Monday. And you know, with how much work I had to put into this first year, it meant I wasn't sitting. And yeah, it was a rough time. I finally did start a new relationship with a great girl, but this was the this kind of new pattern that existed for the next many years was, it just felt like something was missing from our relationship. And so although, you know, we had a nice relationship, it was like a year and a half, it just didn't have the legs to survive my leaving for China, even though, I mean, there were plans for that. Yeah, just didn't have the legs. So then I left for China. That was in 2004. And, I went expecting to kind of, strengthen my Buddhist chops, you know, going to this place where Zen came from, and people aren't Buddhist, you know, it's a hobby. It's a hobby in China, you know, I totally had this romantic idea, and, they're Buddhism isn't a way to kind of inform one's life. It's a way to get what you think you need. You know, people are buying incense and burning incense and praying for things that they want. And by and large, this isn't everybody, but it really, I mean, not that it was a huge letdown, but total change in what I expected. But China gave me a whole slew of wonderful benefits. And one is another identity or another insight into identity. You know, so much time, 4 years, so much time spent speaking a different language, so much time in this very different culture. It meant that there is this person, that is Chinese. It's different than the person you're seeing right here. I mean, a couple of a Malaysian and a Chinese guy came to Chapin Mill a week or two ago, and I could feel this person in me kind of showing himself. You know, when I'm talking with these guys, I'm t- touching them. You know, I'm kind of grabbing their arms. I'm getting up closer to them. My speech pattern changes. You know, I'm a different person. There's a couple great stories. The first one, most Chinese people, I don't know most, a lot, probably most, most Chinese people know me by my Chinese name, Ding Zhiwen. And so when every once in a while, you know, someone asks you, well, so what is your English name? You know, how do Americans know you? What do they call you? I'm like, oh, they call me Dan. My name's Dan. And this one time, you know, I had this conversation and like, Dan, like D-A-N, Dan. Yeah, Dan, D-A-N, Dan. Okay. That is funny. Like, what are you talking about? What's so funny? Like, Dan, Don, don't you get it? Don. Like, Don, well, G-Don, Don, what is it? It's like, yeah, G-Don, it's an egg. Dan, you're an egg. What are you, wait, an egg, don't you get it? You're white on the outside and yellow on the inside. You're an egg. Like, oh my God, I can't believe that. That's really weird. But yeah, I mean, they're right. I loved my time in China. You know, I love China. I love Chinese people. I love the language. I love the food. I mean, it was great. I'm sorry. This is another story I love telling. This was actually after I had left. I was back to visit, and it was a summer day, a kind of classic Changsha summer day, super hot. And what that means is, I mean, you just don't want to be outside when it's this hot. I don't know if any of you have spent much time in like a subtropical, tropical kind of climate, but I mean, it just sucks. Being outside during the day sucks. Just so humid, you know, a kind of humidity that just sucks the wind out of you. And so that means is at night, once the sun goes down, people, because they haven't had much of an appetite during the day because it's been so hot, they want to eat a night meal. And people eat these night meals outside, all these restaurants, they bring the tables outside and just set them up right on the sidewalk or in the street. And it's just a great scene, you know, there's lots of barbecue and beer and oh man, it's just awesome. And so I was there. And me and one of my Chinese brothers, and we're just having this night meal, and a storm was moving in. You know, you could definitely, it was in the air, lots of wind, lots of movement, really kind of dramatic, and it was just great. So he invites a couple of friends, and we had already drank quite a bit and just having a great time, and yeah, the food in Changsha where I lived, was really spicy, so it was really easy to drink a lot. And so some friends of his show up, a couple of guys, a couple of girls, and so we order more food, and they order some more drinks, and now we're into like heavier stuff. It's called baijiu. It's this like rice grain alcohol. You know, the stuff's like over 100 proof. It's terrible. But you just, you know, you get used to it. And it's just a real part of the Chinese experience. So we're drinking this baijiu and getting hammered. And I don't know if any of you in here have spent a lot of time speaking a different language, but for me, because of that kind of like self-perfectionist thing, I didn't want to say things that, I mean, this is under normal circumstances, I didn't want to say things that I didn't really know I was saying correctly. You know, I wasn't likely to take a lot of risks with my Chinese and grammar and vocabulary, things like that. You know, I wanted to make sure I was saying it right, or else I just wouldn't say it. But when alcohol was involved, you know, I was much more likely to take some risks. You know, I was definitely a bit more fast and loose. And so we're getting near the end of this meal and getting near the end of this baijiu. And I said, 我们的酒快喝干，我们就可以喝风。And this is a kind of poem. I mean, you can kind of hear it, just even if you don't speak Chinese, you can hear it. You know, that kind of that 酒, 酒 in the middle of it. 我们的酒快喝干，我们就可以喝风。And at the end, those two words that have the same tone, 喝干，喝风。And so what this means is, our drinks are almost gone. They've almost been drunk dry. But that's okay, because we can drink the wind. And, and my Chinese brother's friend, he goes, ah, 丁志文，你比中国人中国的。He's like, ah, Dan, you're more Chinese than a Chinese person. You know, to say that kind of crap. That's a different identity. And just to, like, to know that that exists, to know that that can exist, I think really helps in these Sesshin experiences, you know, where we see these aspects of ourselves, and you're like, oh man, you know, that's not going to change. But it does. I mean, this identity stuff, it's not any big deal. It's so malleable, so changeable. So, yeah, I want to wrap up. I don't want to go on too long. But yeah, so came back from China, had a great 4 years teaching here in Rochester, back at Aquinas at my alma mater. Had, you know, good classes and, you know, good relationships with kids. But kind of like what had been happening in my relationships. And there's another one in China that ended up being kind of more of the same. And this time at Aquinas, it was more of the same. And this is a kind of feeling of something missing, feeling like things aren't quite right. And so it was also during this time, after coming up from China, that I got more serious about practice. I pretty much, I think, was on a daily practice. I started going to Sesshins in 2009, and because I was teaching, you know, only got to go to that summer Sesshin, but really started pretty serious Zen practice. And so after this kind of lack got a little bit unbearable, I was like, okay, well, I'm gonna go on staff. We're gonna really have a go at this. See what's up with this. And so came on staff in the summer of 2012. And I've learned a ton. It's been incredible. I mean, it's great being on staff. They get Zen jokes. And everybody's working on themselves. I mean, it's really great to be in an environment where people are really working on themselves. I mean, it's incredible. Maybe there's other places where you could be in a situation like that, but man, it's really exceptional. And we're all very different people here. Roshi, he recently said he thinks that people either, I'm not sure if he said they come to practice or they stay with practice because of an experience of the beyond. And of course, he would have a lot more insight into that than me. But I think, too, maybe in addition, that a lot of people are here because of loss. I mean, and maybe just loss is a part of this human experience. But it's really interesting to learn about the kind of loss people have suffered through and what they're doing to really come to terms with it. yeah, I really think that's been an important part of my time here, is just learning about, yeah, people's loss and seeing the loss for myself, you know, my own losses, and it's been really helpful. And of course, you know, going to Sesshin has been wonderful, and seeing my own framework, you know, Aitken calls them our old friends, you know, the defensiveness, the self-perfectionism, you know, you just less and less kind of keeping them at arm's length and being like, oh, it's you again. Hello. I didn't realize you were still there. Okay. Jeanette, Prince Cherry, she compares it to, the relative who always has bad advice for you. You know, you're like, okay, yeah, sure, Grandma, uh-huh. I'll get right on that. Like, no, not that. Just again with practice, I mean, Chip and Mill has been wonderful. I've been there for like 2.5 years. It's been, there's just enough time and space to explore the land, explore myself, and to have the kind of teacher support there has been wonderful. In preparation for this talk, I asked my mom, I asked another friend of mine, so, you know, if you could tell me any benefits that you've seen for, you know, my time here on staff, you know, what would they be? And my mom thought I had gotten more patient. She thinks I'm more comfortable with being myself, comfortable, you know, just she feels I'm less torn. So there's a kind of comfortability, a kind of ease that I didn't used to have with myself and with the kind of situation. She thinks I laugh more easily than before. And of course, I've learned a ton of skills, which has been wonderful. A close friend of mine, he sees this perfectionism. And it's kind of like related to what I've come to see as a kind of Virgo, like tendency towards absolutism. You know, you really, this is the way things are. You know, it's kind of a disregard for the complexity of everything. And, I think it's been really wonderful being on staff. And just seeing how complex things are, like having like the time and the space to recognize the complexity of just all things, and not how much things change. You know, just it's that anxiety is so quick to put blinders on us, and we have these blinders on, and I think those blinders are what keep us from seeing complexity, and they also keep us from recognizing the change that can happen, just that is happening, not can happen, is constantly happening. Yeah, the blinders of anxiety just sucks. And also my buddy talked about the wholeness of practice, you know, and kind of breaking down the this idea of absolutes. I think I've been able to make practice, or just make so many aspects of life opportunities for practice, little chances. I mean, the gardening has been great in that regard. You know, there are few activities that involve as many metaphors for meditation practice and this kind of life on the path as gardening. Gardening has just been really wonderful. So, I'm really, really appreciative of, you know, this 3.5 year chance to do a lot of great exploration and opening, and yeah, it's been great. Yeah. So thank you all really tremendously. It's been, yeah, great ride. is that, that's it? I mean, it's 10:30.
Yeah, I mean, we do, we are running out of time, but we can throw in a couple of questions.
Yeah.
Two or three questions at the most. Oh, I've got a question for you.
Yeah.
You know, it occurred to me, I've been with my family so much, and it was only when I turned 28 and I actually moved here, when I actually moved in a different country, in Canada. And it was years later that I realized that, for me, maybe that was a way for me to actually permanently cut the umbilical cord.
Mm.
If you had that kind of experience going to China.
Yes. I mean, it allowed me to recognize, like, they hardly called me in China. If I wanted to talk with my family, I mean, I shouldn't say that. If there was going to be communication between my family and myself, it was because I initiated it. It really let me see, they've got their own thing going on. You know, my parents, they've got their own thing going on. My siblings, they got their own thing going on. You know, which is fine. But, you know, being in that extremely foreign environment, you know, where I was, I mean, especially in the beginning, but I mean, all throughout it, in a lot of ways, I was alone, and just fine, you know, and really, I mean, I had a great goddamn time. China was awesome. And so, yeah, I didn't need these people around to have a great time. So, yeah, I think that's right in a lot of ways. But, I mean, here I am back. And actually, that raises something interesting. You know, the Chinese are so focused on their families that really was a big reason that I did come back, is because I had felt like I had adopted so much of this kind of Chinese outlook on things, that to be away from my family was kind of wrong. There is a part of me that felt like I wasn't doing a good job as an oldest son being so far away from my family. Yeah, really kind of strange, but yeah, I definitely remember feeling that. Yeah.
So what are you going to do?
That's a good question. So far things aren't really in place. For the short term, I'll be subbing in the city most likely for cash flow. But longer term, I imagine I'll try and hook up with, be a part of some smaller nonprofit organizations, things like the Gandhi Institute or Seed Folk, or working with city kids that is not in a traditional classroom, and hopefully doing like mindfulness and or working outside. Yeah. I mean, hopefully. Who knows how that's going to work out? I have no idea. But, you know, another great benefit of being on staff is you see how little you really need to get by on, you know. And in China, too, I lived a pretty simple Spartan lifestyle, so that's I'm not afraid of eating bitter for a little while things, you know, kind of settle out. I've got a wonderful support system. I mean, between the Zen Center, my family, friends, you know, having grown up in Rochester, yeah, I'm gonna be fine. Yeah, not a worry.
Dan, can you talk a little bit more about your decision to go to China, how long that was in the works?
I thought I was going to do the Peace Corps, and I wanted to go to Asia, and I thought I'd be going to Mongolia, because the Peace Corps didn't send people to China. But the woman I was dating at the time, she said, oh man, you know, 2 years is a long time. Can we kind of, find some middle ground here? And so we bought this book, like Alternatives to the Peace Corps, and found this organization, World Teach, and they went to China. It was only a year-long thing. So that's what I settled on. But, yeah, I don't know why China, but it just really called to me. It just, really, I have no idea why. Just one of those kind of karmic, connection things. Yeah, and I mean, it was funny. I was there for a month. initially she planned on doing it with me, going to China with me. Then she decided against it. But, you know, we were still going to try and make things work. And I was there for a month before she just said, yeah, I can't do this. I can't wait for you to come back. And, yeah, I mean, that was tough. You know, I was quite alone then, being new in this country and not having much of a support system, not having many relationships, and to lose that one was big. It did make space for me to just absolutely fall in love with China and my colleagues and my friends. And yeah, so it was wonderful not to have that, you know, to have to think about that relationship then.
All right, Dan.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.